Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, September 15, 2014. The head of the opposition political party says South Sudan government has hijacked the talks in Addis Ababa.
And the government would want to muzzle the other point of view. They would want the parties which are with them in the government to represent the political parties.
And Bakita Radio is set to reopen after security agents return the keys.
Officially, there were no conditions given to us, but only during our discussions, they told us that we should try our very best not to go into politics. We should only have developmental programs.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The on again, off again South Sudan talks scheduled to restart in Addis Ababa today has been delayed once again, this time for what the Intergovernmental Authority for Development, or IGAD, calls logistical problems. An official with IGAD not authorized to speak to the media told South Sudan in Focus that the talks have yet to get underway. Its reporter Iskander Freo has been in Addis Ababa monitoring the talks and has this update.
The talks are for the first time moving to a relatively far location from the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. They will be held in the tourist city of Bardar, 178 kilometers northwest of Addis. And the government delegation has been there for 2 days now. I spoke to the spokesperson for the government delegation, Michael Lees, and he said he is waiting for the arrival of the other delegates, the HPLMA in opposition and the former detainees. Otherwise, according to him, all the stakeholders are already in Bardar and they are waiting for the opening of this round of talks in Bardar.
Is there any reason why they moved the talks from Addis Ababa to Bardar?
There has not been any statement from the mediator, from the Intergovernmental Authority for Development so far, and it's not known why they moved the talks to Bardar.
The SPLM in opposition have their representatives in Addis. Did you talk to any of their members about the next round of the talks?
I managed to talk to the spokesperson of the SPLM in opposition, General Lul Kwang, and he said they are going to leave for Bardar tomorrow and they will join the talks for sure. But he also added that they maintain their position on the signing of the matrix and on the proposal of the Government of National Unity. That's a proposal by the IGAD leaders regarding the formation of Transitional Government of National Unity in South Sudan. He said they will not sign the matrix and they will not sign it unless the Ugandan troops and other foreign forces withdraw from their country. I mean, regarding the formation of Transitional Government of National Unity, he said they are not ready to accept a proposal that will keep President Salva Kiir in power for another 3 years. As you know, the Transitional Government of National Unity is supposed to stay there for 2 years and a half, and that's what the General Lul was referring to.
What about the other groups? There were the faith-based groups and civil society groups and other political parties that were supposed to be at the talks. Do you know anything about those other groups?
I asked the minister, Michael Makui-Lewis, yesterday, and he said all of them are already in Bardar, except for the opposition and for the former detainees. So all the stakeholders are in Bardar, including the government delegation and the former detainees and the SPLMA in opposition are expected in Bardar tomorrow.
That's Skander Freo reporting from the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa earlier today. Delegates from opposition political parties are now saying they might not attend the next round of IGAD-led talks. The announcement that they are on the fence about whether or not to go to the talks comes after the opposition political party said in Juba that they have dismissed Lamakwal from his position at the head of their umbrella group at the negotiation in Addis. Lamakwal's dismissal came after he accused the government side at the talks of lacking the political will to resolve the crisis and attempting to intimidate other stakeholders. On Saturday, Akwal was to travel to Addis Ababa to start for the start of the next round of talks, which mediators say will focus on the formation of a transitional government for South Sudan. But security agents at Juba International Airport barred him and three other opposition officials from leaving South Sudan.
Well, I was told by the immigration officer that I cannot travel. And when I asked him why, he said he has directives from the Minister of Cabinet Affairs not to allow us to travel to Addis. Well, of course, he was not told why. This is what we will find out from the government as to why they have done that. So we are going to request the government to clarify the reason why we should be denied our constitutional right.
He says the decision to remove him from his position is the government's making.
This is just propaganda from political parties that are in the government, and the government would want to muzzle the other point of view. They would want the parties which are with them in the government to represent the political parties.
Akwal insists he will travel to the talks as the chairman of the political parties forum. He says the mediators have already sent him his air ticket and are expecting him to show up. He says the opposition umbrella group has made its position at the talks very clear.
We wrote a paper in which we said for peace to come and for any transitional government to be effective, the top executive position must be shared between the government and the rebels. And we have suggested that the current president continues as president of the state, and we create a new position of prime minister who will be head of government to be occupied by the rebels.
The stumbling block, Akwal says, is that the government is not willing to share power. Peter Abdulrahman Sule, the leader of the United Democratic Front opposition party, has been blocked three times from attending the talks. Sule's party pulled out of the opposition umbrella group. He says the members of the United Democratic Front believe most of the parties in the forum are influenced by the government. Sule says he also thinks the government is deliberately disregarding the views of other stakeholders at the talks.
This is one way of trying to weaken the political parties and trying to sideline the political parties from what is actually a national problem. We see a national solution, not two people only who decide, who having found themselves controlling arms and armies, decide that it is they alone who decide what is now a national catastrophe and which therefore decide what the solution should be. I don't think that's good.
Other opposition leader Cornelius Kohn says the umbrella group has written a letter to President Kiir, the African Union, IGAD, and the international community. The letter accuses the government of putting roadblocks on the way to peace efforts.
We have written a letter to the President, IGAD, the European Union, and the African Union, and copied all friends of IGAD so that we let them know the government is not serious about the peace talks and that they are intentionally delaying the signing of any peace agreements until the 2015 elections arrive so that they can regain the confidence of the people once again.
Participants in the South Sudan peace talks were given 45 days at the end of last month to set up a transitional government. An earlier deadline brokered by IGAD in June to set up a government of national unity came and went without no action on whatsoever. IGAD has been leading the talks for South Sudan since January, but the negotiations have had little success in ending the 9 months of conflict that has killed thousands and displaced 1.8 million people. VOA fellow Lucy Pony, Michael Atit, and our team in Juba contributed to this report. Bakita Radio says it will soon be back on air. The Catholic radio station was given green light by government officials to reopen more than 3 weeks after they were shut down by security agents. As Philip Thornaleo reports from Juba, President Kiir ordered the agents to return the keys of the station.
Bakita Radio Director Albino Tokwaro applauded President Kiir for intervening.
So the keys were officially handed to us, and we had to write an official note that we received the keys and that nothing was stolen or got missing from the station. And that was it, and the security man left.
Tokwaro says the keys were returned over on Friday, but he says an administrative procedure within the Catholic Archdiocese of Juba is delaying the resumption of the station's normal operations. He says while they did not receive orders about what they could and could not air, security operatives did advise management against covering politics and the ongoing conflict.
Officially, there were no conditions given to us, but only during our discussions, they told us that we should try our very best not to go into politics. We should only have developmental programs.
Four Bakita staff members were arrested about a month ago, and the station was taken off air for reporting on the rebel bills regarding fighting between government and rebel forces in Unity State. Security officials said a report on Radio Bakita in mid-August suggested government soldiers launch the first attack on rebel positions in Unity State's capital, Bentiu. The government said Bakita misinformed the public by quoting rebel sources who said government forces instigated the fighting. Security officers released three of the four employees a few hours later, but detained news editor David Ochan for several days. He was released without ever being charged with an offense. Last week, President Salva Kiir finally signed into law three media bills approved by Parliament more than 9 months ago. Many journalists complain they have been harassed or detained by security officials for their news coverage. The media laws are expected to guarantee journalists' right to access information and freedom of expression. For VOA News, I am Philip Thornaleo in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, tens of thousands of people disappear around the world each year. Find out why. That report and many others are coming out after this.
You don't want to miss VOA's South Sudan in Focus. You can hear us on one of our FM affiliate stations around the country or on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan. In Juba, listen to South Sudan in Focus at 8 p.m. on 93.5. You can also find us on shortwave at 11995, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz. Or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Define what a good friend means to you.
Okay, a good friend is a person who is trustworthy, as in, as a friend, he or she can help you when you need her. She's always there to help you when you are in a certain situation. Yeah, for me, a good friend is a person who's just trustworthy, a person who's, yeah, a good person.
A good friend is a person whom you interact with truly, who is trustworthy to you, a person who is mutually beneficial to you.
A good friend is someone who is so close to you, knowing particularly who you are, and who is concerned about you, your day-to-day activity, your well-being, and wants to know how healthy you are.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. West African governments are being urged to ensure human rights are respected as they battle the ongoing Ebola outbreak. Human Rights Watch say the response to the crisis has been slowed by ignorance, fear, denial, and mistrust. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Human Rights Watch says protecting rights is a crucial element in controlling the unprecedented Ebola epidemic ravaging the region. Corinne Dufka is the group's senior West Africa researcher.
We do call on these governments to adopt a human rights framework in addressing this illness, which is creating an incredible strain on these countries which are recovering from armed conflict in the case of Sierra Leone and Liberia, and then decades of authoritarian rule in Guinea.
She says Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone have histories of corruption, abuses by security forces, and media restrictions. Dufka says the protection of healthcare workers is a top priority. At least 140 have died in the outbreak. She says many have raised concerns about a lack of protective suits and equipment needed when treating patients.
We are asking that the government step up to the plate, that international community helps them do that to ensure that the right that they have for protection during epidemics is respected.
Besides health professionals, Human Rights Watch says better protection is also needed for janitors, cleaning staff, drivers, and burial staff. Recently, tension filled the West Point neighborhood of Liberia's capital, Monrovia, when it was placed under quarantine. Dufka agrees that quarantines are needed at times, but says they're often more effective in isolated communities.
Because quarantines necessarily address liberty and freedom of movement as well as freedom to make a livelihood, we're asking that other measures that involve public education, working with the community, cooperative measures, be used instead. These measures are really the least intrusive and restrictive available to be able to reach the same objective.
HRW says quarantines must be based on scientific evidence, and when they are imposed, governments have an obligation to provide food, water, and health care. It says quarantines imposed during this epidemic have frequently not met these standards and have been applied arbitrarily and been overly broad in implementation. There's a gender dimension to the Ebola crisis, too. UNICEF reports that women account for 55% to 60% of the deaths. HRW's Dufka says it has to do with the role women play.
Women are disproportionately represented among nurses and cleaning staff at hospitals and so on. They also care for the sick and then prepare the dead for burial. They're also more likely to be cross-border traders. So all of these professions and occupations leave them more vulnerable to infection.
Dufka says governments must take steps to bridge the information gap about Ebola, which has led to fear and mistrust. This includes public education campaigns and community involvement in prevention strategies. She says that's an obligation defined under the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Human Rights Watch calls on the governments of Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone to adopt a zero-tolerance policy when it comes to abuse by security forces. Also, HRW says the international community must do much more to help African governments deal with the health crisis and ensure transparency into how donor funds are being spent. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations say tens of thousands of cases of enforced disappearance remain unsolved. The UN Working Group on Enforced Disappearances say this bad practice continues unabated in every region of the world. The group has submitted its latest report to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, from where Lisa Schlein has this report for VOA.
The UN Working Group on Enforced Disappearances reports more than 43,000 cases from 88 countries still remain to be clarified. While many of these cases are of recent vintage, the chair of the working group, Ariel Dulitsky, says many date back decades.
We consider that enforced disappearances are a continuous crime, and until the fate or whereabouts of the person that disappeared is established, the crime continues to happen.
The working group was established in 1980, largely as a consequence of Argentina's dirty war, when many political dissidents were abducted or illegally detained in secret prisons. More than 3,200 cases from that period remain unsolved. The cases remain open because enforced disappearances are considered a crime against humanity, so it is not subject to the statute of limitations. The UN defines an enforced disappearance as one government or people acting with consent of that government abduct a person and then refuse to disclose that person's fate or whereabouts, in effect, placing the person outside the protection of the law. During the latest period of review, from November 2012 to May 2014, the working group has made known 418 new cases of enforced disappearances to 42 states, including 93 under the group's urgent action procedure. The report notes Iraq has the largest number of disappearances with over 16,400 reported cases. Sri Lanka has more than 5,700 cases, Algeria more than 3,000, and El Salvador, Guatemala, and Peru each have well over 2,000 unresolved cases of enforced disappearances. Dulitsky says new strategies are needed to combat the changing situation of enforced disappearances. In the past, he notes, this practice was used to quell political opposition or ethnic conflict. Now, he says, it increasingly is being used in anti-terrorism operations and to combat drug trafficking and organized crime.
We see also that new technologies that could allow to identify missing persons and disappeared persons are not being used. The DNA tests are not worldwide used. The use of other technological improvement are not being used. Information is not being shared between countries. And so we call all the states to develop new strategies.
Dulitsky says the working group has started a new procedure this past year in investigating enforced disappearances that happen in the context of crimes against humanity. In the last several months, he says the group asked the UN Security Council to refer both North Korea and Syria to the International Criminal Court. Regrettably, he says, the Council has failed to act on this demand. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus, editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. About 30 countries have pledged to support Iraq in its first fight against Iraq with the Islamic State militants by all means necessary, including military aid. In a statement following a conference in Paris, diplomats said the aid should come in line with needs expressed by the Iraqi authorities in accordance with international law and without jeopardizing civilian security. It highlighted the urgent need to remove the Islamic State group from regions where it has established itself in Iraq. The conference included the United Nations, European Union, and the Arab League. It is the latest step in an effort to build a coalition to battle the Islamic State group, which has captured large areas in Iraq and Syria. Iran says it has rejected a request from the United States to join the fight against Islamic State militants in Iraq. In remarks on state television, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said the U.S. ambassador in Iraq asked for Iran's cooperation, but that the request was rejected because the U.S. has, quote, dirty hands, end quote. He said U.S. statements on forming a coalition against Islamic State fighters in Iraq are blank, hollow, and self-serving. And finally, the U.S. military is set to lead peacekeeping exercises today in western Ukraine involving 15 nations as President Barack Obama prepares to host Ukraine's president for talks at the White House later this week. The Defense Department announced the 12-day exercise earlier this month, saying 1,300 personnel would take part, including 200 U.S. soldiers. The deployment is the first involving U.S. ground troops to Ukraine since the crisis began there earlier this year. The exercise comes as fighting continues between Ukrainian troops and rebels in the eastern part of the country. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
A campaign to persuade people in Rwanda to buy a new, improved type of cooking stove, which uses less fuel and is less smoky, is not successful, according to the stove manufacturers. They say the public still does not realize the type of the stove could save money and protect their health, as well as saving trees. For VOA, Nick Long reports from Kigali.
There are various types of improved cooking stoves in Rwanda. One of the most affordable is a combined ceramic and metal charcoal stove called a chanamake. 3 years ago, the Rwandan Ministry of Infrastructure approved a new, more durable type of chanamake fired in a kiln to prevent breakage. The ministry said it wanted 80% of households in the capital, Kigali, to be using this charcoal stove. The new type saves about 30% on charcoal compared with unimproved stoves and 11% compared to the old chanamake, according to the international NGO Practical Action, which helped to design it. But it costs about $7.50, whereas the old chanamake stove costs a little over $2. It's not known how many of the new chanamake are being produced in Kigali, but according to one of the manufacturers, the AJDR Cooperative, it's not many, and sales are falling because the government has removed a subsidy. Alain Nzanzabaganwa is treasurer of the AJDR Co-op. He says they're not selling many of their improved stoves, they're not getting enough publicity, and they're hardly selling at all outside Kigali. In the past year, he said, the cooperative sold just 1,600 of the new chanamake. Nzanzabaganwa thinks there are about 6 places in Kigali where the public can buy the new chanamake. One of these is a market in the Kimironko district. Deep inside this market is a stall with a few stacks of cooking stoves. There were none of the new stoves on display when VOA arrived there, but one was produced when we asked for it. It had a tag with the maker's certificate. The stove vendor, Laurence Uwamahoro, says she sells about 5 of this model each month and 30 of the older model. She said it was more economical than the other stoves, but when asked if she had one herself, she said no, as the $8 price tag was too much for her. A bystander remarked that the new stove is for rich people. You might think Rwandans are crazy not to save up $7 for a stove which could save them well over $100 in charcoal if it lasts for 2 years, as the makers claim. The saving may not be that great if they already have the old chanamake, but even in that case the saving could amount to a few $10 sacks of charcoal. Practical Action's consultant in Rwanda, Ewan Bloomfield, tells VOA there needs to be more clarity about marketing and it should be sold door to door, which is not happening at the moment.
My understanding of the types of approaches which are most effective are when sales agents are able to go and physically visit a household and explain to them the benefits, give them a demonstration of the benefits, and then get backup from another woman or another person of authority in the community who can then, you know, demonstrate to them the actual tangible benefits of the stove.
Currently, Bloomfield says the cooking stove manufacturers don't seem to understand the importance of the retail side of the business. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Stand Alone by K. Danks.
You made me lose my ability. You made me disabled in mind. Due to old failure, spine line. You made me cut myself out of my youth. As if I'm injured, oh, illness, but not. As if I'm weak and low, silent, but not. You made me unable to operate normally, temporarily, unable to move and think fairly. You made me very emotional ill. I saw you need me to be unsuccessful in life. That's why I'm unaccessible. You made me fail to think of any practical solution. Soon own a surprise of revolution. Yeah, stand here. Yeah. Cause I can do it now. Cause I can do it now. Yeah, stand at them. I have to stand alone for a reason why. You made me blind, not to see anything. You made me deaf, not to hear anything. You lock my nose, not to breathe anymore. You control my tongue, not to say in itself. You paralyze my arms, not to stretch itself. You paralyze my leg, not to move anymore. Yeah, I have to stand at them. Cause I can do it now, cause I can do it now. Yeah, I have to stand at them. Cause I gotta access to the process. I'm owning access to the success. Yeah, I'm standing there. Cause I can do it now. Cause I can do it now. Solution in my society. Need to not do thing that people expect me to do. Look, I'm not a chip satisfactory upstandard. You made me fail, accept to test. Right now, I'm ready to protest. Standing on my own, living nose in known, showing you strongly I disagree to do, stay with you and I agree. We must leave fathers away from center of love. A mistake may come and bind us back in buff. I suggest it must be known. Eyes on me from my top to my broom. Young is me, fresh man seeking for room. Now I'm back.
We have been listening to Kay Danks with that song, Stand Alone. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
You made me blind, not to see anything. You made me deaf, not to eat.